But I'm Maris Ash. I'm with Change Lab Solutions. We provide all sorts of innovative law and policy solutions to transform neighborhoods, communities, cities, states, safe places to live, smoke-free environments, access to healthy food, anything having to do with chronic disease control. And I have to say, because I am a lawyer and we're going to be talking a lot about law, I am not giving any legal advice. It's kind of our ethics that we have to let you know this is not legal advice. And if you need legal advice, that you should contact an attorney in your state and they can give you the advice you need. So I'm just doing basically public health education. My public health degree is in health education, so combine that with law, and that's what we have. Before we get in, I'd love to know how many people are working at the local level here? So about a third. And state level? A handful. Okay, and federal level? And lots of people doing, maybe not doing advocacy yet, or maybe not, you're in academia. Any people, academia? So, okay, there's the missing hands. All right, so I'm going to try to frame this so we can talk about different levels of government all throughout the presentation today. We're going to talk about some of the basics of lobbying. What is lobbying? Some of the common restrictions on lobbying. What are the allowed activities? And I want to emphasize the allowed activities, because most of what we do in public health is completely allowed going forward, regardless of 503 and different restrictions. And then we're going to get some examples in Q&A and make this as interactive as possible. So it's important to remember that all governments and nonprofits are allowed to conduct lobbying activities. You can do that. It happens all the time. Local governments have lobbyists at state and federal levels. State governments, you know, I'm from California. California has a delegation that lobbies Congress. I mean, this happens all the time. But it could be the lobbying activities may be restricted by the kind of funding that's being used, and that's what's really important. Philanthropic funding can restrict lobbying, and federal or other government funding can restrict lobbying. And so to find out what you're doing and what kind of funding you're using, this is a good place to consult a legal counsel to understand what's going on in your state and local laws. Okay, so when we go to law school, the whole, you know, you've heard of the Socratic method, and they have all these hypotheticals. We call them hypos. I've got a hypo here that we'll come back to at the end of the presentation. And so think about some of the things we'll talk about in relation to this hypo, and then we'll try to dissect it together, okay? So a housing authority is considering a resolution to prohibit smoking in multi-unit housing. A university research lab is funded by the NIH to study the health effects of secondhand smoke in buildings. So here we've got the academics. We've got the academics, too. At the request of the housing authority executive director, can the university researcher provide a presentation on the negative health consequences of secondhand smoke in multi-unit housing? Can the researcher provide his or her opinion on the resolution? Okay, so that's our setup. We've got an administrative agency asking an academic researcher to provide some information on secondhand smoke for, this is a resolution from an administrative agency. Think about, too, what if this was a law being passed by a city government? Because you'll see there might be some distinctions. Okay, so there's two kinds of lobbying, direct lobbying and grassroots lobbying. And Nicole gave all sorts of examples of grassroots lobbying. So everything that APHA is doing actually is a combination of direct and grassroots. But when they're sending out these alerts to you, that's grassroots lobbying. Okay, direct lobbying. A communication directly with a government official to influence specific legislation. I want to unpack those one by one. A communication includes any email, phone call, letter, in-person meeting with a government official who's involved with specific legislation. All of those activities could be lobbying. What's a government official? This is what we do in the law. We take every little word and dissect it, and it's really important. A government official includes anyone working for a legislative body, not just the elected official him or herself, but staffers too. a legislator, or other government agency department staff who takes part in forming legislation. So it could be the staffers in an agency, if they're involved in creating legislation. Specific legislation includes pending bills or specific proposals. It doesn't have to be just introduced. It can be the pre-introduction, could be specific legislation. Influencing means reflecting a view about the legislation or making a direct appeal. Okay? These are the four elements of lobbying. And if you're doing something that doesn't include one of these things, then you're not lobbying. So if you're not talking to a government official, you're not lobbying. If you're not engaged in a communication activity, but you are doing the government official specific legislation influencing, I don't know how you can do all these things, you have to have all four components in order to be lobbying. Missing any one of these is not lobbying. Grassroots lobbying is similar, but it's a communication encouraging the public to take action. So all of those examples that Nicole was giving about there, you know, just fill this in and you can cut and paste, that's all direct lobbying, encouraging all of you to go in, weigh in on the farm bill, the transportation bill, financing, all these other things. Grassroots lobbying. And then when you go and do it, if you're meeting in person with people, that would be direct lobbying. So remember, just like in direct lobbying, there's components to it, four components. It includes communication with the public instead of a government official to influence specific legislation. So again, very specific definitions of what lobbying is. And if you aren't doing all four of these, then you're not lobbying. And with grassroots lobbying, you have to have what we call a call to action. And that's what really the influence is, not is asking them to take action, download this petition, sign it, send it in, make a phone call, asking the public to take action, a call to action. If you don't have that call to action, you're educating the public and it's not lobbying. So it has to be encouraging them to move forward, to take action to influence themselves as individuals. Without that, you are not lobbying. So common restrictions in lobbying. I want to talk, and I'll distinguish between government grants and philanthropy funding, because there's difference. Government grants, people here who receive federal dollars, federal government dollars, like CPPW or CTG or research grants, probably a lot, if not you as individuals, certainly state health departments get a lot of federal government money, and local health departments do too, might flow down from the state, but originate with CDC or NIH, HHS somehow. So government grants, and states have their own rules, and some particularly large metropolitan areas will have their own rules too, and you have to be aware of all of them. I'm going to talk on a broader level because I don't know every state and local law. In general, and this is definitely true with federal dollars and the CDC's guidance documents, prohibits grantees from using federal funding for lobbying activities. Remember, we had the definition of lobbying activities. It doesn't prohibit state and local governments from engaging in lobbying, not at all. It's using federal dollars for the lobbying, and that's absolutely key. Because you could be doing work on tobacco control with local general fund dollars and do all the lobbying you want if allowed by your city council or town board select persons. So it's with the federal dollars, and that's really important, because we as public health people are not limited from lobbying at all, even if we work for the government. So long as you don't use federal dollars for it and you have permission of your local elected officials. We'll talk about what are exceptions to lobbying. And again, it doesn't prohibit grantees from using non-government funds, particularly federal funds, to conduct lobbying activities. philanthropies are regulated from the Internal Revenue Service. They are tax-exempt organizations, and for the benefit of receiving that tax-exempt status, they can't use their funds for lobbying. It's really important, if you receive philanthropic dollars, that you read the contract that you have with your philanthropy. And this is another place, if you're not used to reading contracts, is to talk with your with a lawyer to read it. There'll usually be a paragraph in the contract saying you may not use these dollars for lobbying purposes. But it's not necessarily there. If you get core support funding from a philanthropy that's just supporting your organization as it's strong in the public interest, you can use those dollars for lobbying. It's not the most common sort of grant, but it is possible. If your grant is silent and you're getting dollars from philanthropy and it's silent, you can use those funds for lobbying. But you have to check the contract because you don't want to be out of compliance. I receive a fair amount of funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and not one penny of that may be used for lobbying. And they are very strict about that. They give training to all their grantees all the time on just what I'm doing, what's lobbying, what's not lobbying, and making sure we thread that needle. But other foundations, the California Endowment, for example, in my home state of California, often will allow lobbying with their funds, but it's a special sort of grant, a core support grant. So the bottom line here is to read your grant document. And if you receive any funds from major donors or private individuals, you can use those funds for lobbying. Those are called unrestricted funds, and nonprofit organizations can lobby quite a fair amount, depending on the size, up to $1 million a year of direct lobbying. I want to talk about examples of exceptions to lobbying for both federal and philanthropic grants. So we had the definition of lobbying, a communication with a government official, influencing specific legislation. Remember those four parts? These are exceptions to that rule, written into either the IRS code or into the federal grant documents. Nonpartisan analysis, study, or research. In our office, we call this Napster. I'm sure that's just our own. But this is on policy or alternatives or specific legislation that may express support for specific policy. I want to unpack what does nonpartisan analysis, study, or research mean. It means it's independent, balanced, and objective. Here's the key: fair to both sides. Contains a full and fair exposition of pertinent facts, allows a reader to draw his or her own independent opinion and conclusion, but the author may include his or her conclusion too. The conclusion is based on evidence and facts, but not unsupported opinion. This is really important, and a lot of the work that gets done in public health is what we consider nonpartisan analysis, study, and research. Certainly everything that comes out of my office, we develop, at Change Lab Solutions, we develop model policies. If you want to get smoke-free housing, you can go on our website and look at any number of different ways to generate smoke-free housing. And with specific laws, examples of laws that could be adopted in your community. This is not lobbying, because we encase it in nonpartisan analysis. What do we know about secondhand smoke? What do we know about the drifting smoke from apartment units within buildings? What do we know about asthma and secondhand smoke? What are the objectives? We've got concerns. Landlords have concerns that they go smoke-free. How will they enforce it? The legal aid attorneys are afraid of homelessness from folks, and they don't want to do it. So we talk about all sides of the issues and then say, if you want to move forward, here's a model piece of model legislation that you can adapt to your community needs. That's not lobbying, because it has that nonpartisan analysis. The fifth version of this is that it must be broadly distributed to the public and not to just one side of the issue. So we put it up on our website. We announce it for all to see. Everybody who wants to have access to this can go online and pull down a sugar sweetened beverage model legislation. If you want to have taxes, if you want to do portions of size, like New York City, there's models up there for all of that. If you want to have safe routes to school and need some model legislation, anything that we've got all sorts of things, none of which is lobbying, even though model policies are embedded right in it, because we work really hard to fall into this exception to lobbying so that you have access to resources in the communities to know how to move forward and with some well-evidence-based approaches. Another exception to lobbying. At the request of a government or legislative body, a technical or factual presentation or of information to the government decision makers regarding specific legislation or a legislative proposal. So you notice this is a communication to a government official about specific legislation, and you can say your own opinion, all the elements of lobbying, but it is an exception to lobbying. Therefore, it is not lobbying if you get a request from government. Now, I want to talk about what that request means, because it's really important. Under federal rules, you must have a written request. Under IRS rules for philanthropy, they don't use the word written documentation, written request, but it's best practice to have it. And it must be for the whole committee or the whole legislature. It must come from the mayor. Would you come talk to the city council or to the chair of a state hearing, a committee that's doing a hearing on behalf of the whole? It can't be, would you come to my office and talk to me privately? It must be done in a public forum on behalf of the whole committee so that everybody gets access to that information. But this activity is just like it meets all the criteria of lobbying, except it's one of the exceptions. Therefore, it is not lobbying. Government officials may communicate with one another on the same government agency about policy or legislation. This has been a huge place of concern with federal funds, particularly CPPW and Communities Putting Prevention to Work. Those are the stimulus funds that came through and the community transformation grants work that's going on now. Can my local health department talk to the city council about whatever we're doing, safe routes to school or access to healthy foods or smoke-free environments? Can we talk? And the answer, and we're using federal dollars. The answer is yes. When you're at the same level of government, this is with federal funds, it is your job as a health officer, as a health department, to provide the elected officials with public health information and analysis and what's the data and an opinion on whether smoke-free environments and a piece of legislation goes far enough in protecting the health. Yes, you can. It is an exception to lobbying. It's called the traditional executive-legislative relationship exception. You may have that communication to a government official about specific legislation and try to influence it. Where it becomes really tricky, and I can't tell you one way or the other. I can give you my opinion about California as an example, but you really need to talk with your elected official or your local council if you want to talk to somebody at a different level of government. So I'll give you the example, the hypo in California. We are predominantly have county health departments. We have 400, I think 86 cities in California. We have 58 health departments. Three of those are city health departments, Berkeley, Pasadena, and Long Beach. Everything else, 86 other cities, 85 other cities in Los Angeles County go to the county health department. Only Pasadena and Long Beach have their own health departments. Can the health officer from the county health department talk to city councils? That's the question. And the CDC regulations in Section 503 of federal grants are silent on that. They say it has to be part of the normally recognized executive-legislative relationship. Now, if I were county council in Los Angeles or San Francisco or Alameda, any of our counties, I would say there's no other health department here. We have to have that traditional executive relationship. We've been doing it for how many years? You know, decades and decades. Yes, you can. But that will be an individualized decision that local governments will have to make. And can we talk to the state health agency? What if that state health agency is helping to influence and shape state legislation on tobacco control or BCD prevention or emergency preparedness or anything else? Can we talk to them? And you'd need to be able to make the case that it would fall within the executive legislative traditional relationship. And if you can make that case, then yes, you can talk to them. And it's not lobbying, and you can use federal dollars to do that. A county health department may discuss specific legislation with a county supervisor. A county planner, like an urban planner, may discuss updates to the zoning code with the county public health department. Absolutely, you can do that. Policy-related activities that are not lobbying. Educational campaigns. Not lobbying. So you have everything that APHA does about something but doesn't have that call to action, that's an educational campaign. Going out and talking at community meetings, educational campaigns. Sharing best practices and success stories, not lobbying. Coalition building among governments, nonprofits, the private sector, community members to discuss problems, share ideas, not lobbying. Even if you're discussing policy options, it is not lobbying, because what's lobbying? A communication with a government official trying to influence a specific legislation. If you don't have all of those things going on, it's not lobbying. And pulling coalitions together to say, what is the evidence in our community? What should we be doing to address health disparities and increase equity? And what policies do we need to do that? That is not lobbying. You're not, and even if there are government officials in the room, which often happens at coalition meetings, unless you are encouraging that person through his or her government relations to take action, or authority as an elected official to take action on a specific piece of legislation, if you're not doing that, you're not lobbying. So it's lobbying only comes when you've got those four requirements and you don't have an exception to it. So, for example, if you have a coalition and then a specific piece of legislation is introduced that your coalition supports, if you get a letter from the mayor or the committee chair to come and present, you're in an exception to lobbying and the coalition can go and present their thinking. That is not lobbying. Broadly sharing evidence-based approaches to include model legislation. I talked about that. That's what we do at Change Lab Solutions, not lobbying. Other allowed activities, educating the public about personal health behavior, communicating to the public about health risks and consequences. This is the everyday work of public health, right? Working with private sector organizations. Okay, so here we come back to our hypothetical. And I want to know, is this lobbying or not? A housing authority has considered a resolution to prohibit smoking in multi-unit housing. A university research lab is funded by the NIH to study the health effects, and at the request of the housing authority, can the university researcher provide a presentation on the negative consequences of secondhand smoke? Can the researcher provide his or her opinion on the resolution? I'm going to just open that up. Take a second. What do you think?
Ask for viewers back there somewhere.
What do people think? Somebody raise your hand. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, why? Who are you and where are you from?
I'm from Maine, and I'm a pulmonologist, and I've had to defend the pulmonary medicine. That would be disseminating information that is already known and established in the interest of public health.
Yes.
Well,
it could be lobbying if it had a call to action and influencing legislation. They have a resolution going forward. So it could be lobbying, but I think you're right that it is not. Go ahead.
It's at the request of the health. housing authority executive director and therefore is an exception.
That's right. It falls into an exception of lobbying. It falls into an exception of lobbying. And when you can, you go and you do your presentation, you can talk all your pulmonology information, all the science, you bring it with you, and you can give your personal opinion because you're not having an exception, you're within an exception to lobbying, so it is not lobbying. So you can say what you think as a public health professional and as an individual. I want to tease out a little piece here. Oh, yes, in the back.
In this meeting where you're going, I think the second question is actually a little more complicated because just the way that that question, and I'm Dave Dale from the Heart Association.
Great.
The way that the question is worded doesn't really give me enough information to give a definitive answer because one of the keys to whether or not he can provide his opinion on the resolution is if his opinion is based solidly in the science that he just presented. So, you know, he could present science that says smoking in multiple unit housing is a bad thing for public health, but I'm opposed to this resolution. So if he's not basing his opinion on the science, then he is lobbying.
That's a good point. I just assumed that one's opinion would go along with the science, but it's a good point. You can't present one side and then contradict it with your own opinion. Now, if you think the science is mixed and you say on the one hand, on the other, that's absolutely fine because your job there, why you're being called forth as the academic would or the public health leadership in a community is because you know how to make these balances and they would like your opinion and the information. And often we have mixed information to present, and that's absolutely fine. What I was going to drive to here is the housing authority is considering this, and it's something I didn't really dig into earlier, is a distinction between legislative bodies and administrative agencies. So we have Congress, but we have HHS or the EPA or Department of Transportation, the administrative agencies that create the regulations. So Congress will do the law, and the administrative agencies will do all the regulations that really go into the detail of Congress's vision for how things should unfold. And under the IRS rules, when you can engage with administrative agencies all you want, and it's not considered lobbying. Lobbying only takes place with legislative bodies, not administrative agencies. So there's big pushes. I just spent the last session at a tobacco control workshop on looking at a lot of e-cigarettes and menthol cigarettes, and what's the FDA going to do about it? The FDA was there talking, Mitch Sellers, what they're going to do or what they're considering. The FDA is an administrative agency. You can use philanthropy dollars to put in all sorts of testimony to administrative agencies without lobbying. But that is not true for federal dollars. It's an important distinction. So with federal dollars in this newest round of iteration 503 that came out a couple of years ago, administrative agencies are now considered the equivalent to legislative bodies for lobbying rules. So if you are a tobacco control advocate, want to weigh in on menthol cigarettes, for example, you can do that. You just can't use your federal dollars to do that. That would be considered lobbying. So in this instance, if we've got federal dollars and it's housing authority, it might be considered, we have an exception, but it could be considered a place where you would lobby. And if it were a city council, it definitely could be lobbying if it weren't for the exception that you're falling into. So you need to really pay attention to, do you have the four elements? Can you find yourself an exception and get around those lobbying restrictions by falling into an exception? And in almost every instance, you should be able to do that, either through an invitation, a publicly noticed written invitation to come and testify, or because if you're a government agency, you've got that traditional executive legislative relationship that you've had for years and you can point to, this is my job to provide them information. Here's a hypothetical exercise. County Health Department receives a grant from CDC on tobacco. May the health department develop model legislation for banning smoking in public places. What do you think? What do you think and why?
Bueller?
The answer is yes. Two things. It's a model legislation. They're going to change it, and you're just giving them a model if they want to move forward. And this is maybe a little self-evident to say, this is what your CDC grant is about. If your CDC grant is about nutrition or emergency preparedness and you use it on tobacco control, that's kind of, it's not really a lobbying question, but it is something that CDC would look at if they're, you know, somebody claims that you've been impermissibly using federal dollars for lobbying. They'll go in and see what your grant's about. So you got to work within the scope of the grant. And then you could, if it's a model that you're giving them, and you could download one of our models or any other one that you like and provide it to them as a model that they could take further action on. How about this? May the health department discuss the model legislation with county supervisors? And what about with the cities within the county? And we went through this a little directly. What, so with the county supervisors? Yes, that's their job. That's the exception, the executive legislative exception. And what about the county to the cities or the county to the state? People are nodding yes, and I'm going to say you got to check with your local council. Do you have that same executive legislative relationship with the other levels of government? And that's going to be a local call that needs to be made. I gave you what my opinion would be if I were giving advice in California, because I know how that state works. But your state is different, and you've seen one state set up, you've seen one state set up. We have other, Florida, New Mexico, Hawaii, all the local health agencies are state employees. What does that mean? I don't know. If you're from any of those states, probably other states like that, you really need to delve into how you're set up and whether you can use this exception. So, what activities can I do under my contract or grant? Does my funding include a restriction on particular activities? Does my activity fit within the definition of lobbying? If my activity might be lobbying, what can I do that is not lobbying? What's an exception? Nonpartisan analysis. Getting the invitation to speak. Having one of those executive legislative relationships. Those are all exceptions that give you huge opportunities to have frank and straightforward conversations that you need to as a public health agency. Important tips. If you engage in lobbying, so this is when you're really, really doing lobbying, I'm almost done, I'll come to your questions. Maintain accurate and detailed records to distinguish what you're doing with non-lobbying activities. If you're really doing lobbying, which happens and you can do, you just need to make sure you're not using federal dollars for it. You're using general fund dollars or donation dollars, what we call unrestricted dollars. So as long as you're using unrestricted dollars, you can lobby. But you've got to be able to show on your timesheet, oh, this was lobbying, and I used a different source of funds for that. That's what we do in my office. We put right on our timesheet whatever we've done lobbying, and we pull that out of our core support funds so that we can easily distinguish that we haven't used federal dollars or philanthropy dollars. And your standard time reporting is usually sufficient. I've seen it even if you don't have, you know, we do online timesheets. If you don't have that, you can make notations. Somebody keeps track of those notations, so you've got the paperwork backup. So lobbying's allowed. Restrictions on lobbying vary depending on the type of funding. But most allowable activities are not lobbying, and just be sure to read your grant or contract. Talk to legal counsel when necessary. And there's all sorts of resources on our website, the Change Lab Solutions website. There's tons and tons, all the IRS documents, the CDC documents, the federal rules of every form and shape. We contracted with law firm Feldelsman Tucker. They're a DC-based law firm that specializes in representing nonprofits and government agencies specifically on lobbying issues. And they wrote a memorandum really unpacking this 503, that's the language that many people will know, the federal rules around lobbying with federal dollars. It's all unpacked there in great detail if you're a lawyer, in more simple prose, if you don't want all the detail, but it will help you with that. And we've got webinars that you can download and listen to, too, by the Feldman Tucker attorneys. Really encourage that if you get stuck, to have your legal counsel listen in on those, or your whoever does time sheets and whatever. There's the Center for Lobbying in the Public Interest and the Alliance for Justice. So I just draw you to those resources that are out there ready for you to use. And I know there was a question right up front, and we'll take questions, and any of us and all of us are available, but go ahead and speak so everybody can hear you, and tell us who you are.
My name is Susan Harris. I'm from New York State. And I'd like to, I'm actually a professor at the State University of Albany.
Can people in the back here? So, yeah.
In any case, I'm interested in knowing how far you can go to solicit an invitation to address.
Yes, yeah,
if you suggest to somebody that you would like that information?
Yeah, absolutely. So the question is, how can we actually solicit these invitations to speak to, you know, assembly committee or the city council or whomever? Absolutely. Because sometimes, I mean, we get calls like this in our office. We're not allowed to lobby, say, tobacco control. All of our funding is from our state health agency. We're not allowed to use our dollars for lobbying the state legislature. So we say, you know, we can't come and talk with you, but if you were to invite us in writing from the committee chair, we'd be glad to come and testify, because that would put us into an exception for lobbying. So absolutely you can do that.
Can I add?
Yeah.
There's also an organizational hierarchical issue. If you're in a government agency, for example, or perhaps in a company or whatever, where, you know, I know you'd be shocked to hear this, but with an HHS, there's some, you know, entities that try to control all conversations going between the executive department and Capitol Hill. Meanwhile, you know, down at the working level, there are all sorts of people in categorical programs of tobacco or cancer prevention or whatever that are working with committee staff on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, not always do every piece of communication filter up through the Assistant Secretary for Legislation before it goes over and down the food chain. And somehow it just happens that we got invited to testify. We don't know how that happened, but it did. So, you know, you have to be mindful of whatever your organizational line of discipline is. And certainly right now in some centralized health departments in some states, you have to be very, very careful and thoughtful about not putting yourself at risk by soliciting this in a way that will come back to bite you.
So I'm not talking employment law here. You know, so if you have chains of command that you have to communicate with because that's how your health agencies operate, I'm not saying, sure, go ahead, ignore all that. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that if you're a researcher at SUNY Albany and you would like to present some public health information to the state legislature or to the Albany City Council, but you're on federal funds or philanthropy funds, can you call them up and say, I've got some really important information that I'd like to present. Can you invite me? Yes, you can do that. So just to make that distinction, because I'm not saying throw employment law to the wind and leave yourself unprotected.
Just as a follow-up to that, then I should not put it, suppose I'm going to take my class and they want to do, you know, some information to a legislator. I shouldn't put that in writing if you invite us to come. In other words, make it an oral
repeat the question.
So the question is, if I make that request, can I get an invitation to come and testify? Should I put that orally so there isn't a paper trail on it? I don't think you need to do that. I think you can be very straight up. Listen, I'm not able to present because of the type of funding unless I have an exception to lobbying. One of those exceptions, I mean, it's very straight up. This is in the IRS code. These are in federal regulations. It's not a wink, wink, nod, nod. These exceptions are in the law. You're allowed to fall into an exception, and you're allowed to ask, May I fall into an exception, please? Give me an invitation. Absolutely, you could do that. It's not, it is not wink, wink, nod, nod. It is straightforward, this is the law. So, yeah, in the back and then here. So say who you are and... this is where you can get into a wink and a nod, and there's some General Accounting Office opinions on this. So if everybody knows, and you couldn't be in that town not knowing that there's a specific piece of legislation, a soda tax or something, but you don't use, you know, piece of legislation number 325, if it's so self-evident what you're talking about is a specific piece of legislation, it's not going to pass the test. But if you want the city council to take some action on corner stores, they're not doing anything, and you want to move them to action, there's no legislation, come on, we've got a food policy council, and we want our food policy council to do something about access to healthy food. That's not specific legislation. So you can't be too cute by half in this regard. Does that make sense? Okay. Here, and tell us who you're from and speak so everyone can hear.
My name is Nancy Dalter. I'm from the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. I'm curious about, I guess it would be grassroots lobbying through the news media, say a letter to the editor or an opinion piece. You know, what the...
Right. If you'd go to those four elements, is it a communication with the public, trying to influence. It means it has a call to action on specific legislation. If it has those four elements and no exception, and there isn't an exception, oh, you put this in the media. That is not one of the exceptions. So if you have those other four elements, it is lobbying.
Okay. What if it's just my name in the paper, Nancy Dalter? I don't identify myself as my title and associate myself with the university. Is that...
If you're using federal funds to do this, if you're writing the letter with federal funds, then it would be an impermissible use of federal funds. If you're not writing the letter with federal funds, then you are, you know, a researcher at the University of Arkansas, and what I would do if you want to be extra special careful is on your timesheet say this was lobbying and I used my private time. This is lobbying, I used allowable sources of funding.
Yeah, I mean, I could write it in my, you know, I could write it on the weekend, but then if I want the readers to know that still who I am because I'm in public health, even though I wrote it on my
You can phone. Definitely, we are, this is a First Amendment right, is to petition government, and it's right there in the Bill of Rights, is the right to petition government. So we can lobby, you just can't do it with certain kinds of funding.
Oh,
yeah, in the back.
Hi, my name is Peter. I'm from JSI here in Boston. And I don't have a question so much as just to draw attention back to Nicole's presentation at the very beginning.
Speak up a little.
Oh, sorry. I think Nicole at the beginning made a kind of a call to action to engage with APHA on advocacy issues and the ease with which they do it. And from personal experience, I just want to mimic that. I think APHA does a great job, and I think Nicole, being a staff of one of two people, I think she does a really amazing job at engaging members where they're at and really helping you get the message that you want out through the association. So I want to recognize her role in it because I think they do a great job.
Thank you, Peter. Do you want to emphasize anything, Maria? I saw you.
No, I'll give you a going out point.
Okay, all right. Other questions, challenges you've had at the local level? Let me raise a challenge for you. If you haven't seen it yet, you may see it soon, which is real pushback on public health trying to regulate, quote, legal consumer products. That would be alcohol, guns, tobacco, junk food, junk beverages, legal consumer products. It would also be pharmaceuticals. should the government be in the position of having anything to say about what goes on legally in this country or not? And this is a big pushback that we're beginning to see, not just around lobbying, but also in the courts. We had one of the tobacco cases on FDA go up, and a justice at the DC Circuit questioned why government is regulating legal consumer products. So I want to raise this because you might hear it in a newspaper near you, that there's some, the very basis of public health is being questioned, that we have in our whole constitutional framework this concept of the police power, and it's not cops and robbers. It's actually the responsibility of government to legislate to protect the public health, safety, and welfare. This goes back to feudal times, the knights in shining armor, where people paid taxes in form of labor or crops, and the knight would protect the populace from the health, safety, and welfare. And that got translated right across, the Atlantic Ocean, and is really embodied in our constitutional framework. It's the power really of state and local governments. It's not a federal government power. It's a state and local government power to protect the health, safety, and welfare. Now, the federal government has lots to do with all of that, but it's not inherent in how the federal system is laid out. And so if any legal consumer product has the threat of harming the health, safety, or welfare of the population, it is the role of government to legislate, and you do have the authority to do that. It's really pretty core to the whole reason of government, and I know we're in big, culture wars with ourselves as a nation on what is the role of government, and do we need it, and how much. And one of the ways it's being expressed, and it might, if you're a public health agency giving testimony, you might be challenged on, well, these are legal products, why do you have anything to say? So I just throw that out as a little warning, and just to give you the confidence that, in fact, this is the role of government. Health, safety, and welfare. Health comes first.
Solus populi, supremus lex. The health of the people is the supreme duty of the law.
So do you want to... Yes.
Yeah. 2 minutes, one virtual
maybe
slide.
Another question.
Oh, go ahead. Take the question. In Atlanta, come see me afterwards. I can connect you up with someone, an old former CDC colleague who's now working there on that. Maris?
I want to say you need lobby. To get that kind of legislative pressure to get a tobacco. We've lost so many tobacco tax battles in California. It's embarrassing. And it's because we are outspent by the tobacco industry in lobbying. So, we had all the coalitions, we had everything, but we didn't have enough lobbying money to really get the muscle. You got to get lobbying money. And Cancer Heart wanted to bring some of that because they have donations. Somebody passes away and you write a check in memory of somebody, and other reasons that people donate to these great organizations. Those dollars can and are used. We've got somebody from the Heart Association in the back. To win those hard-fought campaigns, you need straight-out lobbying dollars, I think. And you combine that. It's quite a beautiful dance, the lobbying, non-lobbying dollar dance. But you need both.
Final thought comes from Martin Luther King. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And that drills much deeper than you think in public health. And the King got that statement from a writing 100 years previously, a New England abolitionist minister named Theodore Parker. And King took it, and with that magic that he could do, distilled it down. But in my lifetime and in public health, I see this play out in what we're doing now. I mean, you go back to 1947, Mahatma Gandhi, the concept of a passive non-resistance for recognizing the nationhood of people. And that was taken over by King to use, again, passive non-resistance to turn around segregation in this country. And that manifested itself in the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 1964. Very profound bends in our moral and political universe. And then we had the AIDS years, and we had the leadership of Larry Kramer and ACT UP and the AIDS Action Coalition changing the culture of this country that people with AIDS should not be discriminated against. And we came in 1990 to the Americans with Disabilities Act, a profoundly egalitarian principle copied by all modern democracies after that, that people with disabilities shall not be discriminated against and shall be reasonably accommodated in public settings. Okay? And so we come now today, 2009, to this divisive debate still going on about the Americans with Disabilities Act and health reform. But in my opinion, we passed a point of inflection, because embedded in that is the concept that people will not be discriminated against on the basis of pre-existing medical condition. Regardless of how this food fight goes on over the website and sequestration and closing down government and the debt ceiling and all that, I don't think this country will go back on that. So let me close with, here is what Theodore Parker wrote in 1853. That's the original six lines that Martin Luther King then extracted from and distilled down. But it makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up every time I hear this. And I use it at this point in my class talking about advocacy and making a change. The cadence is King. It's prescient. It's written 100 years before King. Listen to this. I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. Its arc is long, and I can see but little ways. I cannot construct its curve, nor calculate its figure by the use of sight. But I can divine it by conscience. And from what I can see, it bends towards justice. This is what you are doing. This is what public health advocacy is about. You are bending that arc towards justice for your communities. And we, on behalf of the panel, we salute you for it. Thank you.